Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August's Nurses Scope webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in anaesthesia and analgesia, Carol Broadbrook. Thank you, Carol. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and welcome to this afternoon's webinar. We're going to talk through today anaesthesia for the brachycephalic patient. Just as an introduction then, I'd like to go through the topics that we're going to be discussing. I'm going to start by looking at some scenarios that you may come across with regard to brachycephalic patients in terms of how they present and what procedures they may require to have performed. We'll then move on to look at considerations for anaesthesia, look at brachycephalic airway disease itself, and use this to then move on to how we might consider our anaesthetic management. We'll also focus on some pieces of equipment and how they may be best utilised, and perhaps bits of equipment that we haven't necessarily thought about that may also be useful for brachycephalic anaesthesia. We'll concentrate then on patient examination prior to anaesthesia and preparation for the anaesthetic period. And then finally, and probably most importantly, the anaesthetic and recovery periods themselves as well, particularly focusing here on the critical phases, which are primarily induction and recovery from anaesthesia. I'd just like to show here this video of this pug recovering from anaesthesia, and I think this is really something that we should be aiming and thinking about, the extubation in the dog. We'll talk about some differences to the cat here, how important it is to extubate as late as possible but as safely as possible. You can see here that this dog is tolerating being in sternal recumbency, it's got very good muscle tone, and is then safely extubated at this point. So what scenarios may we come across when we consider the brachycephalic patients? And I think I'd just like to highlight these three areas here of cases that I think we may be presented with. The first being a recovery post a planned surgical procedure. And this may be a routine procedure that's elective, it's been booked in, and we're aware that the patient has airway disease or potential for airway disease, and we're therefore likely to be quite well prepared for this case. We'll be able to monitor changes during the induction period that may impact onto recovery, and we're not dealing with something in an emergency situation. The second would be recovery post a more urgent surgical procedure, perhaps presenting with something like an abdominal surgery that requires rapid or quick intervention. And here we may be less prepared. We were not aware that the patient was going to be presenting to us. We might not have everything in place. And this might mean that in the recovery period, we've got things that we need to focus on that may be more of a concern for us. And then the third scenario may be perhaps recovery post something that, such as airway surgery itself. So we may have had to intervene because of an emergency. Airway obstruction or partial obstruction that required us to perform anaesthesia and maybe some surgical intervention or some non-surgical intervention at this point. So this would be much more in an emergency scenario, likely to be less well staffed and certainly less well prepared. So I think these are probably the three main areas that we're going to consider for our brachycephalic patients. So when considerations come to mind in terms of what we may be expecting to come across during anaesthesia, I think important things, and I briefly touched on this before, was species. There are going to be differences between how we may manage a canine patient compared to managing a feline patient. And then we've got breed considerations as well. And we may certainly find that some breeds are less likely to tolerate us manipulating and intervening with them compared to others. So this is an important factor when we think about that. And the example I would give here would be that's the difference between our French bulldog that we've got here compared to our English bulldog, compared to our pug. And these are the three most common presented brachycephalic canine breeds that we see. And certainly the French bulldog is becoming more and more a common presentation. How we may deal with them, how they may interact with us, and what they may let us do with them is important to consider. And this is going to impact on the drugs that we use. Then we're thinking about the airway disease that these patients may present with. Obviously, this may be separate, a comorbidity to their original presentation. So brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome, thinking about airway obstruction, this is going to be a concern for us when the patient is sedated following pre-medication and also in the recovery phase of anesthesia. On top of that, we've got drug-induced relaxation, muscle relaxation, which is likely to compromise further the upper airway function. A number of our brachycephalic patients will also present with some degree of gastroesophageal disease and may already have been noted to regurgitate. And that may not be linked to anaesthesia, it may be a normal thing that the owner has noted during that animal's day-to-day function. This may be due to something such as a hiatal hernia, and equally it may be down to stress. Certainly some of these breeds can be particularly stressed in the hospital setting away from their normal environment. So our considerations then in terms of our brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome is that these are patients that present with a dynamic upper airway obstruction. It's not the same all the time. It very much depends on things, as I mentioned, patient stress, and also on in terms of when the patient presents to the hospital and the anaesthetic protocol, the drugs that we utilise and how we interact with that patient. How stressed do they get in that recovery period when their airway is not normal? What are the components that we are interested in? And we'll talk more in the induction section about how induction of anaesthesia should be used to assess the airway as well as to intubate the trachea so that we can plan the recovery phase. So very commonly we see an elongated soft palate, and that can be very commonly the cause of that upper airway kind of stridor, stertor that we notice during these patients' normal function. And certainly at induction of anaesthesia, as the muscle relaxation occurs and we compromise the ability to move air through the mouth, we really hear that soft palate. This may then obviously become a problem into the recovery period, depending on how well the patient is able to lift their head and pant or breathe through the oral cavity. Stenotic nares will compromise this further because it's likely that airflow through the nasal chamber is going to be compromised. And once the patient is unable to breathe through the mouth, then nasal airflow would be usually relied on, but is not a function in our brachycephalic. We've then got two components within the pharyngeal and laryngeal areas that are likely to further compromise airflow, particularly during the inspiratory phase. So we've got enlarged tonsils, which can have everted out of the tonsillar crypts, and these may be compromising flow through the pharyngeal region. And then the second common scenario that we're dealt with are of everted saccules, so our saccules within the ventricular region of the larynx. And these are often due to significant changes in airway pressure during inspiration. These are all sucked into the lumen of the laryngeal region, and that can completely obstruct airway gas flow, or it may just partially do so. So a soft palate, an elongated soft palate, stenotic nares and inverted saccules are certainly three common presentations with these patients. Finally, we may also be dealing with a patient that's got, on top of these physical abnormalities that we see within the upper airway, may also have tracheal collapse, which may be present at different levels of the trachea. And it might be a patient, therefore, that we can grade in terms of tracheal collapse. This is much more likely, if present, to cause us problems in recovery than the other issues, and will really compromise patients in this period. Let's think then about pieces of equipment that we would like to have available to us. And I'm going to list these as really as essential pieces of equipment and then move on to some other components that may be useful for your clinical practice. Having good IV access is going to be an essential component. And I think as nurses we're well placed to be very good at getting IV access. Sedation, obviously this is going to be something that we're going to have to discuss with the veterinary surgeon, but if you find the patient's particularly stressed on admit and the procedure's not going to be either that day or until later that day, it may be appropriate to discuss with the veterinary surgeon about whether some sedation will be useful to reduce stress levels. Next, we're going to think about ability to supply oxygen. This is going to be something that's very useful, particularly post-premedication and into the immediate recovery period. I'll go through on the next couple of slides about what components I like to have in an airway box so that we've got everything together in one place and we're able to quickly collect pieces of equipment that might be essential at a particularly difficult part. Suction. So something like what we've got here, where we've got a setup of suction tubing, saline for water for flushing the esophagus, and some ability with suction tubing to be able to do this. Useful, particularly then if patients regurgitate during any of the anaesthetic periods, so some sort of a regurgitation box. An intubation kit, it may be that we need to re-intubate at certain phases, or we have a difficult intubation, so again having everything in either an intubation or airway box kit. Crash kit or crash cart, so that we've got drugs available to us so that we can perform CPR if that is required, if we have a difficult, particularly difficult patient. And then finally, I think really essential, a calm environment that allows us to ensure that the patient does not get stressed during these very critical phases. Just an example here of a of an airway box, airway kit, just something that's very easily recognised. If anyone has asked for this, then it can be easily sourced. And it may be even useful to have this so that it's by the patient during the hospitalization or at least with them at the induction and recovery phases. And in here you can see we've got a laryngoscope, an extra laryngoscope, and we've got some devices to be able to secure the airway if required in a difficult setting. So some dog urinary catheters, some laryngeal mask airways. We've also got tracheostomy tubes, we've got stylets and bougies as well for being able to examine the airway. We also need a good range of endotracheal tubes. These patients often have a much smaller airway than we might expect in a patient of equal size and body weight. Just another example here of an airway kit and components in there. Another component that is certainly useful are the standard venous cannulas with their stylets. And if we have an airway that we cannot secure in a timely fashion and we are concerned regarding patient oxygenation, then having these available for you to give to the veterinary surgeon so that we can very easily do a percutaneous tracheostomy, where we go through the skin and through the spaces between the cartilage and strings of the trachea in the ventral neck, and therefore we can give oxygen via this route until we're able to secure the airway if we are having a particularly difficult intubation. So it's useful to have all of this set up and ready. And one of these kind of toolkits is a great place to have all of these pieces of equipment in one place. So what we're going to think about having contained within there, I mentioned some of these things already. So the ability to be able to visualize with good illumination the airway, so a laryngoscope with blades of suitable length. Really important that when you use a laryngoscope blade that we're able to place it easily underneath the epiglottis, and we're able to get good visualization of the airway. So really arrange a selection of endotracheal tubes so that we're able to intubate the trachea relatively quickly. Dog urinary catheters, so that again we're able to place a urinary catheter into the airway. Talk a little bit about intubation. If we can't easily pass an ET tube into the trachea, we can pass a dog urinary catheter in, and then we can pass our ET tube over the top of that urinary catheter. A really nice way of being able to do that in that difficult environment. A stylet, or sometimes called a bougie, and this can allow us to manipulate the shape of an endotracheal tube, particularly the soft silicone tubes. Sometimes I keep them flipping over the top of the trachea, regardless of how you hold the position of the head for the veterinary surgeon. And these can be useful to direct the tube ventrally. Other components that we might want to keep in here, some induction agents, so some propofol, some alfaxolone, whichever is your induction agent that you use, so that if we end up with a patient in the recovery phase and they start to have significant respiratory distress, then we are able to induce anaesthesia and intubate immediately and not again have to go and search for those components, and therefore some syringes and needles as well, so that we're able to access drawing up that drug in a timely fashion. Just to briefly mention two additional airway devices that we should consider certainly having available to us. The first on the left here is a tracheostomy tube, and these would certainly be something I would recommend having available for the brachycephalic patients. Anything from sizes around 4 up to 6 millimeter will be suitable for use in the majority of the brachycephalic patients we have. And although we're not obviously planning for a tracheostomy with any of these cases, if we have a particularly difficult patient in the recovery phase and we are unable to recover successfully from anaesthesia, it may be that these are required. The second airway device on the right of the slide here is a laryngeal mask airway, and this is the human anaesthetic equivalent of the V-gel airway device that we now have available for cats and for rabbits as well. And we'll talk a little bit into the recovery period about whether I think it's suitable to consider using these in that phase. So we'll move on to patient assessment, and although this is obviously primarily something that the veterinary surgeon will gain information from the client, I think it's important for everyone in the team to be aware of the patient's exercise tolerance, what respiratory effort and noise the patient may already present with, whether there's any evidence of previous regurgitation, which we already mentioned, previous anaesthesia, if there's a record of a previous anaesthetic, this can be useful for assessing the size of ET tubes that may be required to be available, and also, but primarily part of the veterinary surgeon, in that we've got informed donor consent, concentrating on what airway complications we may run into with that particular patient. any comorbidities, so thinking here about regurgitation, maybe a hiatal hernia, and maybe the disease that the patient is presenting to have the procedure for. And obviously the procedure itself in terms of body positioning and how that may impact on the airway in the post-anaesthetic period. A standard clinical examination, it would be important that the veterinary surgeon obviously informs you of their finding if there's anything that is abnormal beyond what we would expect to auscultate in terms of upper airway noise in these particular patients. Respiratory effort and pattern. And then from an anaesthetic period and a maintenance phase, particularly body weight and body condition score, these patients are often obese due to poor exercise tolerance or body condition. And it's important to be aware of that it's going to impact on our ability for patient ventilation. Finally, then just think about temperament. This may have a significant impact on how we can interact and how easily we can intervene when something is not going to plan with these patients. How easily can we get IV access? How easy can we allow that patient? Will they let us tolerate them being intubated for a longer period of time and extubating late? If you've got a patient perhaps that's either very nervous or aggressive, it may be very challenging in that recovery period, and the airway can very easily become compromised. So hopefully, with all of that information, as a team, we can allow an ASA classification status to be gained. So here we're thinking about the scale 1 to 5 scale. From 1 being a healthy patient to 5 being a patient that would die without intervention and therefore without anaesthesia. We would often place these patients at 2, which are patients with mild systemic disease, or maybe if they've got significant disease, at 3 with significant systemic disease as well. And that allows us to focus our plan and focus the team on how important certain phases of anaesthesia will be. So we've got that, we've got our patient factors, and we've got the particular disease process, both the brachycephalic disease and the patient presenting disease as well. And I think although we can use safety checklists in all cases, anaesthesia-wise, I think these are important cases so that we ensure that we haven't forgotten any steps and we are able to have prepared all of the equipment that we require. We're much more likely to have a smooth and successful anaesthetic in terms of both our own stress levels and patient outcome if we have or we are well prepared in these cases. So a safety checklist, not dissimilar to the one shown here on the slides, can certainly be useful to allow everyone to focus and to run very quickly but very smoothly through the steps pre-induction here. Before the procedure starts and before the veterinary surgeon starts the procedure, particularly here, allowing you as the nurse monitoring anaesthesia to give any concerns if you have any at this phase. And then finally, before the recovery period, and obviously here we're going to primarily be talking about our concerns with regard to the patient's airway. So I mentioned the kind of overall anaesthetic assessment and risk, but we do have certain periods where we're going to be concerned, particularly about risk in our brachycephalic patients. Pre-anaesthesia, primarily once we've given pre-medication, but then thinking about induction and intubation while we try and secure the airway. Once we've secured the airway during maintenance of anaesthesia, this is probably the least concerning of the periods associated with the anaesthetic process. We're then going to be thinking about the recovery period, and this really is a focus for us, and we should be utilizing this as a part of anaesthesia, and therefore we continue to monitor patients thoroughly and very carefully into this period. It may be that we want to perform blood work or other diagnostics to look for any abnormalities prior to anaesthesia that we have not been previously aware of. And it may be in cases that are not emergency, so they're elective, planned procedures, that these may lead to postponement or delay. And therefore, it's ideal to perform them prior to the day of anaesthesia where possible. So both blood work, diagnostics, maybe imaging, and maybe echocardiography, if anything is detected that's abnormal. Performing on the morning of anaesthesia often just delays patients being able to be timely, have their procedure performed. I mentioned already that we may be thinking about sedating patients even on admission so that they do not get stressed out while hospitalized. Worth thinking about using emlocream on perhaps on the cephalic region of the forelimbs so that we can have successful vascular access being gained. It can be very useful when we're gaining IV access that the patient doesn't jump when we try and place the stylet on our catheter through the skin. Considerations for prophylactic treatment of regurgitation, if that's appropriate in that case. I'll talk a little bit about that further. We have our airway equipment, and we've been through some sort of patient safety checklist. There are a number of studies looking at fasting and regurgitation prior to, or looking at fasting prior to anaesthesia and impact on regurgitation. And up until recently, there was evidence that we could have shorter periods of starvation and have reduced the risk of sequelae to regurgitation, so the contents that were regurgitated were likely to be less acidic and the patient would not suffer from significant harm following regurgitation. Some newer clinical evidence has come forward now, so a study from 2016 where they showed actually that a light meal at 3 hours, so previously the kind of 3 to 4 hour period was thought to be superior, actually increased the risk of gastroesophageal reflux. I think therefore with these, with our brachycephalic patients where we already know they may have esophageal disease, that a shorter fasting period is not ideal unless it is an emergency scenario and an emergency situation. And certainly they found risk factors to be associated with the patient age, so increasing age increased the risk, patients in dorsal recumbency, the duration of anaesthesia, the longer the duration of anaesthesia, and fasting as well. So important considerations here. So maybe a longer faster period is going to be appropriate in these cases. So our normal sort of 12-hour overnight fasting period would be recommended. Thinking then about pre-medication, I touched on differences between the breeds that that present to us, so the three common brachycephalic dog breeds. And certainly I think our pre-medication is going to be focused towards the procedure itself, but it's also going to be focused towards the breed and the temperament of the patient that presents to us. And therefore, in that respect, then perhaps with the pug breeds, using an alpha 2 based sedation may be most useful. So combining that with your opioid of choice, depending on the procedure and your practice protocols. And in the French bulldog, an acepromazine based pre-medication, so acepromazine with an opioid that your clinic would use in that situation. And with this, we may find that we get the best level of sedation and we minimize stress around that induction and into the recovery period. Just being aware that when we use alpha 2s at low doses prior to anaesthesia, that we are aware of how long they may act for, the length of the procedure, and therefore whether we are going to have sedation in the recovery period or not. Our requirements for pre-medication, and then we've kind of highlighted them there, that we've got sedation required with either our alpha 2 agonist or acepromazine, and we've got analgesia if it's a surgical intervention provided by our opioid of choice. Options wise, then, from an analgesic point of view and an opioid point of view, methadone at the doses highlighted here, or buprenorphine, they will be suitable for providing analgesia. And sedation-wise, aspromazine at these relatively low doses, if we're giving it intravenously, maybe that we require higher doses if we give it intramuscularly, and medetomidine and dexmedetomidine within these kind of rough reference ranges. If we're using alpha-2s intravenously, we should be prepared to have a rapid induction phase following this if the patient has an airway compromise associated with the sedation and muscle relaxation given by the alpha-2 agonists. It's important, we already kind of discussed about using sedation prior to IV placement on admission so that patients don't get stressed. I think if a patient will tolerate IV placements, then IV pre-medication is certainly suited. We're able to give it shortly before induction of anesthesia, and we're able to monitor patients into that period. It may be, though, that some patients do not tolerate IV placements prior to sedation pre-medication, and therefore we're only able to place an IV following IM sedation and pre-medication. Gastroprotection-wise, we very commonly utilize omeprazole for all of these cases now. Omeprazole is a proton pump inhibitor. And ideally, if we can, if it's a patient that's been on omeprazole orally, then if they've had it within the 24 hours prior to anesthesia, that would be ideal. If they've not had it, then we would try wherever possible to give omeprazole IV prior to induction of anesthesia. There's one paper that documented giving omeprazole orally prior to anesthesia reduced the incidence of didn't reduce the incidence of gastroesophageal reflux, but it increased the pH of the gastric contents, and therefore we were less likely to get severe esophagitis and other sequelae. Once we've started omeprazole, recommend to continue omeprazole for 5 days post-anesthesia if that patient has any signs of regurgitation or reflux during the anesthetic period, unless they are already on this drug. Vascular access is going to be essential prior to induction of anesthesia. That's one of our critical phases, and we do not want to have to be struggling with vascular access at that time. We're going to need it if we need to administer any emergency drugs during that phase as well. I would always consider using perhaps a pelvic limb vessel, so the lateral saphenous can be very useful in these little dogs that sometimes don't like you touching their front feet and can be quite challenging. It's often easier to cannulate that lateral saphenous. And also, if they become a little bit unhappy and maybe a bit snappy associated with their front feet, they often are quite calm during hind limb vessel cannulation. We should make sure that cannula is well secured in place so that we're not going to lose our IV access during the induction phase. And if we, for any reason, perhaps surgery procedure-wise, require additional IV access, this should be gained after induction of anesthesia to avoid and minimize stress. So the induction phase is going to be based on an IV agent dosed to effect to facilitate endotracheal intubation and airway assessment. For this, we do want to have good airway illumination. So a laryngoscope is ideal in this situation, or some sort of head light device. That means that where we directly look at, we are also lighting that area as well. So good illumination is essential, depending on whether or not you prefer to use a laryngoscope. The veterinary surgeon should be aiming to assess tracheal diameter and laryngeal function at induction. And with that information, you, as the veterinary nurse recovering the patient from anesthesia, is going to be able to make a plan for how that phase is going to be performed with the vet during the anesthetic period. The size of the ET tube that we use is also going to be important when we think about what airway resistance might be like and how that patient's going to cope into the recovery period when we actually have to remove the endotracheal tube. So we should be ensuring that the patient is at a sufficient depth of anesthesia for intubation unless we're assessing laryngeal function prior to intubation. Otherwise, a patient we'd like to stimulate the patient with intubation, and that may cause regurgitation, and it may have a significant sympathetic response as well. I like to keep the patient in sternal recumbency for the whole of intubation, with the head elevated, and to have checked the length of the ET tube prior to intubation, that we're not going to be using a tube that's too long. And we should intubate, and we should check and cuff the tube appropriately prior to letting the head place back down onto the table so it's level with the abdomen. If we were to do that before we've secured the airway with cuff inflation if required, then any regurgitant material that's moved into the mouth could potentially be aspirated into the airway. So, an important consideration at this time. Maintenance of anesthesia. Inhalation anesthesia of the agent that the clinic that you work at is most used to using, so isoflurane or sevoflurane. The benefits of using inhalation anesthesia, we get a rapid alteration in the depth of anesthesia with these agents. We're able to alter depth of anesthesia with using our vaporizer setting, and we're also going to get some bronchodilation as well, and that's going to help us from an airway perspective. Negatives, though, the more inhalation agent we have to administer, the more vasodilation and respiratory depression that we're going to see. So the use of a good pre-medication with appropriate analgesia and appropriate intraoperative analgesia will mean that we minimize the dose-dependent vasodilatory and respiratory depressant effects of our chosen inhalational agent. During maintenance of anesthesia, ventilation is potentially going to be compromised by patient anatomy. Already mentioned that they're often have quite high body condition scores. They've got large amounts of intra-abdominal and maybe intrathoracic fat as well. And down to patient anatomy and patient positioning, we may find that the animal hypoventilates during anesthesia. The solution to this is going to be us providing IPBV, so either manual breath giving by manual bag squeezing, or mechanical ventilation, whichever of those is available and appropriate in the situation, obviously under the guidance of the veterinary surgeon you're working with. From a monitoring point of view, it's going to be ideal to have capnography available from a ventilation perspective. Therefore, we're going to be able to monitor for patients that are hypoventilating and have high end-tidal CO2 during anesthesia, and therefore we're able to intervene appropriately with either manual bag squeezing or mechanical ventilation. We should also be looking at thoracic wall movement and assessing that this is adequate in these patients. From a monitoring point of view during anesthesia, standard monitoring techniques that you have available will all be excellent for use during these procedures. From a patient positioning perspective, we should be supporting the head and the neck when required. Mentioned when we were talking about ventilation that when patients are in dorsal recumbency, we may compromise ventilation because of patient positioning and the diaphragm being splinted in a cranial position due to abdominal fat. So it may also be useful in these cases to have a slight tilt and allow the abdominal contents to move away from the chest wall, but not too much so that then the brain is much higher, the head is much higher up than the chest at the level of the heart. Care in lateral recumbency, we may get collapse
depths of that lung that's lowest, the dependent lung, the one that's on the patient lying on. And that might mean in the recovery phase that the patient's not able to ventilate normally through both lungs. It may be that that's an important factor when we consider about supplementing things like oxygen into the recovery phase. We're now going to go through recovery in some detail. I've already suggested that this is a particularly difficult stage of the anaesthetic process, and it can be one where we are faced with a number of challenges. At some point, unfortunately, we are going to have to extubate the trachea and allow the patient to breathe spontaneously. And we really need to ensure that there's sufficient return of upper respiratory tract muscle function at this time. It's not the lung itself that we're concerned about in this phase, unless the patient has documented pulmonary disease. It's collapse of that upper airway tissue, all of that tissue that is in the laryngeal and pharyngeal region. If we've still got muscle relaxation and sedation, that's going to be compromising our upper airway and our patient's ability to spontaneously ventilate. So our aim is going to be the patient in sternal recumbency, extubation as late as safely possible, unless it's a cat. And we need to be aware that we should be extubating at a sensible time that's not too early, but we want to avoid and minimize that risk of laryngeal spasm if we leave that endotracheal tube in too late in cats. So this is primarily for our canine patients. So recovery is going to be a very important phase. Really important that we continue monitoring during this period. This is not the time to be removing all of the monitoring equipment at the end of anaesthesia. And pulse oximetry, then, I would suggest, is the minimum monitoring requirement in this initial phase of recovery. Supplement oxygen if required. Extubate as late as is carefully possible, and avoid excitement. Some way, as shown here, to ensure that the endotracheal tube is protected, and at the moment the patient becomes light enough to lift their head and perhaps start to move the lower jaw and swallow, that they don't bite down and obviously damage the ET tube. This is really our most important thing here, that we want to do it safely, and that means keeping the airway as patent as possible for as long as possible, but not getting into the situation where the animal may actually compromise the endotracheal tube and there is a risk here of aspiration of the tube. So we'll just look at another video here. This is a bulldog recovering from anaesthesia from airway surgery. I think this is something they very commonly do, is that they move their heads from side to side, but they're not making effort to either lift their head or do a very good swallow to suggest that we've got good return of upper muscle function. But you can see here, really nice head lift, quite happy to have that ET tube in place at the moment. We want some stimulation, but we want to minimize so that we're not having a patient that's particularly that's very flat at this point, so we're not having a very rapid recovery and then they would become sedated again following extubation. So we want to ensure that they're completely awake and we extubate at that safe and late as possible time. And I hope we can realize that they really do tolerate endotracheal tubes, and a really nice head lift there, that they really tolerate the endotracheal tube as late as possible. Ways to continue to monitor during this period, obviously some monitoring device, pulse oximetry either onto the tongue as shown here, and you can see here that this French bulldog is particularly awake, it's looking at this point, but it's tolerating our endotracheal tube and its head is elevated here on a sandbag, allowing it to be above the level of the heart and the stomach as well. Maintaining good IV access, in this case here, post an ocular procedure where we've got Elizabethan collar placed, just to be cautious with these in this immediate period that they don't in any way compromise the neck or the airway function, and using a pulse oximeter probe here on the lip to get a reading. From a monitoring perspective, the other option for pulse oximetry are the reflectance probes, and these can be used rectally. So these can be very useful if you're performing surgery around the head in these cases, or any case where you're performing head or dental surgery, so that way the pulse oximeter probe is distant from the head, and therefore in the recovery phase, when they're often moving the tongue around, the probe doesn't work very well. Just to be aware that if you're positioning patients for airway surgery, I often find in these cases that because they have such a large, wide tongue that can often become compromised in the pharyngeal area, that you may get poor perfusion through to the tongue itself. So you might get poor SpO2 readings on the tongue, but good readings if you measure peripherally elsewhere, perhaps on the prepuce or on the vulva, or on a skin fold or the ear if that's appropriate. That may mean that perfusion is compromised to the tongue for short periods of time. So it's important that you try and manipulate the position of the tongue so that we don't compromise blood flow through to that for significant periods of time. Sedation is a very important component of the pre-medication phase, but we also want to ensure in recovery that we minimize any stress and excitement. The more that a patient might try to vocalize in this period, the more airway inflammation and swelling we may see in the recovery period, and this might compromise upper airway function during this phase of anesthesia. So we want to minimize stimulation. Already mentioned this extubation. There's nothing where you mentioned if you're having anesthetic, we're coming along, patting you on the chest, waiting for you to recover. We extubate, and then I just go back and become quite sedated again. So it's important that we allow patients to recover slowly and have a good recovery, and we minimize stimulation during that time. If we allow them to do this and they return to normal consciousness, we extubate and they don't become sedated again at this time. So therefore we need to be very careful if we are using further sedation. So relatively low doses of acepromazine intravenously for a quicker onset than giving it intramuscularly, or low doses of an alpha-2 agonist, so medetomidine or dexmedetomidine, with those down to anything about half a microgram per kilo, and waiting sufficient times, probably 1 to 2 minutes, to see an effect before repeating that, if at all necessary. What problems may we run into in the recovery period? We've just discussed in that previous slide about patient excitement. We really want to try and avoid that wherever possible. Excess sedation, this can be something where we're unable to control a patient. We give sedation, we give more sedation, and it all kicks in one go, and the patient becomes quite profoundly sedated. And then that's obviously going to require much more intensive monitoring during that time. Airway obstruction, that can be a concern due to muscle relaxation, upper airway function, or airway collapse if we documented previously that the patient has tracheal collapse. So those are our main concerns in this time. Minimizing those, then continuous monitoring is going to be essential, at least until the patient is very comfortably lifting the head, looking around, very aware of their surroundings, and is able to maintain good airway patency. We should have our airway kit and suction available during the recovery period, And you should obviously alert the veterinary surgeon to anything that's not making you feel comfortable with the recovery period. If we're dealing with a patient that has airway obstruction, we're likely to see increased respiratory effort to start with. So supplying oxygen can be very useful in these cases. Just gently pulling out the tongue, maybe suctioning the pharyngeal area if that's appropriate, just in case there's any mucus that's particularly viscous and sitting in that area. Don't be afraid to, with discussion with a veterinary surgeon, consider inducing anesthesia and intubating and then recovering a second time. Often patients have a particularly difficult recovery initially, but the second recovery period may be much more successful in those cases. If we've got repeated failure, repeated inability to be able to extubate, have we got excess muscle relaxation for some reason? Is the patient so sedated that we need to consider whether we can antagonize the effect of any drugs that we've given? And obviously then with consultation with the owner and the veterinary surgeon, whether further intervention such as a tracheotomy is going to be a consideration. What additional equipment might be useful during this period? Using nasal oxygen prongs, if the patient will tolerate these can be great in the recovery phase to supply oxygen without having to hold either a mask over the patient's face or hold a breathing system close to their mouth. So the human nasal prongs are often very well suited to the human pediatric ones. Good eye lubrication, particularly with our brachycephalic patients, they may also have these quite sort of bulbous exophthalmic eyes and can easily get corneal drying that could result in corneal ulceration. So good eye lubrication. A stethoscope for being able to monitor and auscultate the chest. Thermometer to ensure that these patients don't become hypothermic in recovery, but equally if they become stressed and they start panting, that they don't become hyperthermic as well. So we should be aiming to monitor and maintain normal body temperature. We're going to just mention over the next couple of slides about using nebulization as an additional protocol with these cases, and it may be appropriate to also have an ECG on during this phase if we're thinking about nebulization. So this is something I would think about as a consideration for all of our brachycephalic cases in the recovery period, is the use of nebulized adrenaline. Again, something to discuss with your veterinary surgeon and for the veterinary surgeon to prescribe. We're using adrenaline here for its vasoconstrictive and its bronchodilatory properties, and it can be very useful to reduce the amount of inflammation and edema within the pharyngeal and laryngeal parts of the airway. So our aim is going to be to nebulize using one of the commercially available nebulization devices for about 10 minutes. This is going to be performed once we've extubated the patient. We need extubation so that we allow some air movement. That obviously encourages the nebulized adrenaline to move into that kind of laryngeal, pharyngeal regions of the oral cavity. We should be using close monitoring during this time, and we should be monitoring ECG if at all possible, but certainly looking for changes in heart rate. If changes in heart rates are noted, obviously the nebulization should be stopped and the veterinary surgeon should be informed. It can be repeated after 30 minutes if needed. And as I mentioned, we should be doing this once a patient extubated. Ideal to be able to move the nebulization device, the tubing, between the patient's teeth. Gently pull the tongue out if they let you do that. And that allows for the nebulized adrenaline to actually get into the pharyngeal region. Dose-wise, the standard 1 in 1,000, which is the 1 mg per mil adrenaline solution, can be diluted in these with these dilutions shown on the slide here, and depending on the patient's body weight. And then can we, as I said, nebulize 10 to 15 minutes, repeated after 30 minutes if at all required, and then repeated greater than about every 3 hours, depending on the patient response. But this is can be a very effective way to reduce inflammation and edema within the pharyngeal region. One other option to mention in this final part of the recovery phase and the final part of this webinar is the use of a nasal decongestant. So this is an alpha agonist, so it's going to cause vasoconstriction or locally of the nasal mucosa. So we're going to use this. It's a nasal decongestant that is obviously originally developed and marketed for use in people. And you can apply a single drop into each of the nostrils, either using the applicator that comes with the medication or putting it into a syringe and using it with a soft cannula into both nasal cavity. Either we can do this at induction of anaesthesia, the most useful thing, or it can be used in recovery phase if required. Got a very quick onset, so we're going to get vasoconstriction of that nasal mucosa. It really does improve nasal airflow and airflow through the nasal cavity. It's very rapid onset within a couple of minutes, and it's likely to last up to about 8 to 10 hours, so it's a really long duration effect in the recovery period, and something that I think has made a big difference in a number of cases during recovery. So I'm just going to finish then with a brief summary of some aspects of what we've talked through over the last hour. So really, extubation should be late, as late as safely possible, unless we're dealing with a brachycephalic feline. Continuous and constant monitoring is going to be essential in that immediate recovery phase. And it's really important that we treat recovery as a part of anaesthesia. We should be as prepared as possible, and use of things like the surgical safety checklists will allow us to ensure that we do not miss steps during the pre and anaesthetic phases of the procedure. And don't be afraid to consider suggesting to the veterinary surgeon or have planned with the veterinary surgeon about always inducing, intubating, and repeating recovery a second time if you're having a particularly difficult recovery period and the patient is compromised in that stage. So don't be afraid to do that. We've got then just a couple of questions to go through before we finish this session. And one of them was something I think we kind of briefly mentioned before, which was to think about patient positioning in the recovery period and use of additional or alternative airway devices. So as I mentioned, I always like to have these patients back into sternal recumbency for recovery. So I think it's important not to think about necessarily having to reduce the depth of anesthesia towards the end of the procedure, so allow the procedure to finish. The patient's repositioned into sternal recumbency, and then anesthesia is stopped at that point. So we turn our vaporizer off at that time, so they recover in sternal recumbency. And we don't want to be moving patients or stimulating them at that time. This is the time, as I mentioned, when regurgitation may be a problem. Personally, I don't like to remove the endotracheal tube at this time and consider changing perhaps to a laryngeal mask area that I showed, or something like a V-gel airway if it's a cat. I think I've run into problems before, particularly with patients regurgitating at this point. So I am relatively keen to keep the endotracheal tube in place and cuffed for as long as safely possible. Obviously using one of those, perhaps a roll of tape or a roll of vet wrap to keep the mouth open and prevent the patient from damaging the ET tube. And then the second question was regarding the use of pulse oximeters not working on the patient's tongue. This, as I mentioned, this is something that we do see usually because of that very thick, wide tongue that takes up the whole of the base of the pharyngeal area, and then it's compromised, it's compressed by patient positioning and also by the endotracheal tube, and perhaps if there's anything being utilized if we're actually performing airway surgery itself. So it is important to ensure that tongue perfusion isn't compromised for any period, lengthy periods of time, but using pulse oximetry on other body parts can be useful, so maybe the ears in some cases, the reflectance probes or even the skin probes that you can get now, or the prep use, perhaps the vulva or the scrotum can be other useful places to place the probe so that they're away from the oral cavity. So that would be a, you know, another suitable scenario in that case. Okay, that's the end of those questions that came through. So I'd just like to thank everyone for attending this webinar.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Carol for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.